Documents from the estate of Jeffrey Epstein mentioned President Trump more than 1,000 times. We'll question Ro Khanna, a Democrat on the committee that released the files, on Morning Edition from NPR News. The fight to reopen the government is over. Next up for Congress, coming up with a health insurance plan. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm A. Martinez. Extending Obamacare subsidies would be expensive, though. $350 billion over a decade. Also, a former employee at a Republican fundraising firm sent out emails for years pushing election conspiracies he calls abhorrent, what finally convinced him to quit. It's Thursday, November 13th. On this day in 1922, the Supreme Court ruled that public schools could exclude unvaccinated students. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The federal government shutdown is over. The House passed a short-term spending bill and sent the measure to the president last night. He signed it last night. President Trump blamed Democrats for the 43-day government shutdown.
We're sending a clear message that we will never give in to extortion, because that's what it was. They tried to extort. The Democrats tried to extort our country.
The short-term bill funds most of the government through the end of January. Some programs and agencies get funding through the end of next September. That includes the federal nutrition program, SNAP. It also reverses federal government layoffs and provides back pay for furloughed government employees. The shutdown has ended without a solution for spiking health insurance premiums. Democrats had demanded Republicans restore subsidies for the premiums to win their support for the spending bill and end the shutdown. But that didn't happen. NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin reports that means the 24 million people enrolled in Affordable Care Act plans are in a difficult situation.
The enhanced premium subsidies that have kept costs down for enrollees expire at the end of the year. Without them, costs are going up. For Amy Jackson of Butler, Missouri, her premium is going from under $300 a month to $1,250. She's not sure congressional lawmakers understand.
You know, for them, $1,000 is probably nothing. It's probably what they blow on dinner. But for me, that's half of my wage. You know, I just can't swing that.
She has breast cancer and is trying to get as much treatment as possible into this calendar year. She's been calling her representatives and telling them that people like her need help now. Selena Simmons-Duffin, NPR News, Washington.
NPR has learned the British government is withholding some intelligence from the U.S. military. NPR's Quill Lawrence reports it's out of concern over U.S. strikes on alleged drug boats in the Eastern Pacific and the Caribbean.
Intelligence sharing between the U.S. and Britain has a storied history going back to World War II, and that relationship continues. But according to an official who is not authorized to speak publicly, the U.K. has begun denying certain intelligence sharing requests out of concern over U.S. military actions in the Caribbean because they do not align with British foreign policy. The White House declined to comment. This was first reported by CNN, and in response, Colombian President Gustavo Petro said on social media that his government will stop sharing intelligence with the U.S. until the strikes on the boats stop. The Trump administration claims the military has the right to kill even unarmed drug smugglers on suspicion because it has labeled them terrorist enemy combatants. Quill Lawrence, NPR News.
Secretary of State Marco Rubio dismissed questions about intelligence sharing after a meeting of G7 counterparts. Rubio says nothing has changed with the U.S. operations in the region. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. This is the 10th anniversary of the attack in Paris on the Bataclan Theater and other sites. The coordinated terrorist attacks, including on a stadium, killed 132 people and injured hundreds of others. Commemorations today will be led by French President Emmanuel Macron. The president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta is stepping down when his term ends early next year. NPR Scott Horsley reports he was the first African-American to lead one of the 12 regional Fed banks.
Rafael Bostic has served as president of the Atlanta Fed for the last 8 years. In addition to taking part in the central bank's interest rate decisions, he's overseen activities of the bank in a region that covers all or part of six southeastern states. The terms of all 12 regional Fed presidents expire in February. Those who decide to stay on will have to be confirmed by the Fed's Board of Governors here in Washington. While President Trump will choose the next Fed chairman and any new members of the governing board, leaders of the regional Fed banks are chosen by regional boards of directors, typically drawn from local businesses. Regional Fed bank presidents get a rotating vote on interest rates. The president of the Atlanta Fed's next turn comes in 2027. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Forecasters say a huge storm is pouring into California. It's an atmospheric river that will bring heavy rain and powerful winds to the state through the weekend. There's a big threat of flash flooding. Los Angeles officials are evacuating people from areas scorched by wildfires. There's no foliage in the burn scar areas to hold back life-threatening debris flows. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News, from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Lemelson Foundation, working to harness the power of invention and innovation to accelerate climate action and improve lives around the world. Learn more at lemelson.org. This is NPR.
I'm Heidi Holton. We're excited at KEXE to be bringing you more jazz programming with our volunteer, Paul Kivi, the history of jazz.
Well, I think this is some of the finest music ever made, and it's kind of gotten lost across time. I pick the songs that I love, and there's lots of them, and there's lots to love. The popular music in the late 20s and 30s, especially the 30s and 40s with the big band era, that was jazz. That was the one period of time when jazz was popular music, and so you're going to hear a lot of things that are easy to get into. If you develop a taste for it, then the stuff that happens starting with Charlie Parker in the late 1940s makes sense.
Hear the history of jazz on KAXE with Paul Kivi, Saturdays at noon and Sundays at 4.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C. What do 23,000 documents reveal about Jeffrey Epstein and President Trump?
Coming up, we'll speak with Democratic lawmaker Ro Khanna. He sits on the House Oversight Committee, which made those documents public. Now, opinions vary on what the documents say about Trump and Epstein, the convicted sex offender and alleged sex trafficker who was a friend to the rich and famous. Now, NPR has made its own review of the documents, and they show that in the last years of his life, Epstein paid a lot of attention to his former friend who became president.
NPR's Stephen Fowler has been reading. Stephen, good morning.
Good morning.
I want to make clear what these documents are. Are these the Epstein files that a lot of people in both parties seem to want?
Well, no. There is a fight over releasing everything the Justice Department has on Epstein, but this is a separate set of documents that Congress obtained from Epstein's estate.
Got it.
They came out in two different bunches yesterday. Democrats highlighted a few emails to and from Epstein that mentioned Trump. One was a suggestion from author Michael Wolff in 2015 that Epstein should let Trump, quote, hang himself answering questions about the relationship, or if it really looks like Trump could win, quote, you could save him generating a debt. Republicans then released all of the latest things they'd received from the estate, things like court records, financial documents, books, text messages, and emails. A few of us spent the day reading those, and Steve, it was surprising how many more pages mentioned Trump, easily more than 1,000 references among the pages we reviewed.
What sort of references?
Well, Epstein said he had photos of Trump with girls in bikinis in his kitchen. Trump, quote, almost walking through the door, leaving his nose print on the glass as women were swimming in the pool. Reference to a girlfriend that, quote, after 2 years I gave to Donald. But most of these emails were obsessively tracking Trump's ascent to the presidency from 2015 to 2018. Epstein mocked Trump. He chronicled the various scandals. There's even a 2017 message where Epstein wrote to former Treasury Secretary Lawrence Summers that, quote, I have met some very bad people, none as bad as Trump, and all also, quote, not one decent cell in his body.
The reference to Lawrence Summers there, a reminder that Epstein knew a lot of rich and famous and powerful people in both political parties, but a lot of references to Trump. Has the president said much about that?
Well, the president posted on his Truth Social and has said the whole time that any Epstein-related questions are a hoax. White House spokesman Caroline Levitt said these emails released by Democrats prove, quote, absolutely nothing other than the fact President Trump did nothing wrong. And Steve, it did little to change the push in the House to get more answers about Epstein.
Okay, so those are the Epstein files in possession of the House. Lots of references to the president. What about those other files that you mentioned?
I mean, that is an effort of a few Republicans and Democrats to get the Justice Department to release all unclassified files around the life and death of Epstein, who died by suicide in federal prison in 2019 while awaiting trial. House Speaker Mike Johnson has been opposed to this effort. Just last night, he said the House oversight subpoena process has been a, quote, treasure trove of helpful information about Epstein. But now that Democrat Adelita Grijalva was sworn in after more than 7-week delay, that means there's 218 members who've signed the discharge petition, which will force a floor vote on the Epstein files bill. Once it gets to the floor, potentially next week, it's expected to pass the House. Some Republican supporters predict even more of their colleagues will join and vote for the measure. To have any force, though, it would need to pass the Senate and have Trump sign it, which, given how much Trump's tried to silence any discussion on the Epstein files, seems unlikely.
NPR Stephen Fowler, thanks for your reporting and reading.
Thank you.
California Congressman Ro Khanna joins us now. He's a Democrat on the House Oversight Committee, which released thousands of documents from the Epstein estate. Congressman, so we just heard about that vote that House Speaker Mike Johnson is going to hold next week on that measure, forcing the DOJ to release the Epstein files. Now, that's actually very early, earlier than he's required. Why do you think he's choosing to accelerate that timeline?
Well, this is Thomas Massie and my bill. We've been fighting for it for 5 months. He realizes now, when we got to 218 signatures yesterday, that 40 to 50 Republicans in his caucus will vote for the release. This will be the largest vote of a MAGA base against Donald Trump since Donald Trump walked down the escalator. And I think Johnson is just bowing to reality. He knows that he's going to have this vote, so why not get it over with soon?
Yeah, because he could have waited until December, but that also means that everyone has until December to discuss and kind of go over it.
Exactly. And every day that's passing, there are more Republicans who are joining our effort. Look, this is a case of rich and powerful men who abused young girls. There are over 1,000 victims. This is not really a partisan issue. And the entire Epstein class needs to go in our politics. We need to restore a politics for working people and ordinary people. And I don't care whether there were Republicans or Democrats implicated, that class needs to leave. And the left and right actually is coming together on this.
I want to talk about, though, the substance of the newly released documents. So Democrats released a few specific emails where Epstein mentioned Trump, and that's out of the 20,000 emails that the committee had in its possession. What do you think those particular emails that your party decided to highlight, what do they say about Trump's relationship with Epstein?
Well, those emails clearly show that he had a significant relationship. The emails suggest that he, at the very least, knew that Epstein was engaged in illegal conduct. And the question is raised, well, why didn't he say anything? And how much did he know? And the other question is also raised, who else knew? I mean, from talking to the victims' lawyers who've seen these files, they believe that there are hundreds of men who either knew about Epstein's abuse and kept quiet, or who actually participated in a farm system where Epstein gave them women to abuse.
So, Congressman, are you saying that there could be criminal guilt by association here?
No, I would not go that far. And this effort has never been actually just about Donald Trump. What I will say is that there have been a lot of people who have acted with moral guilt. There are some people who may have criminal guilt. But the point is, these rich and powerful men should not have university buildings named after them. They should not have scholarships named after them. They should not be lionized in society. And so far, they've been shielded. And what Thomas Massie and I are trying to do is expose all of this, have a lead accountability, and make it clear that there was a lot of abuse and corruption in our government, and the focus needs to be on these women and survivors.
Do you think that we will ever kind of get past this? I mean, everyone. I'm talking from Congress to all of us who cover this. Is this going to be just something we'll always have in the back of our minds?
I do believe we can get past this. This vote next week is going to be historic. It's the first time the Congress is going to go on record to say the Epstein file should be released. I hope it'll push the Senate to vote, especially if we get big numbers. And then I hope that within the next 6 months, the files are released. But the reason this has resonated with the American public is there's a feeling that the American dream is dead. There's a feeling that rich and powerful people have too much money controlling our government, that they get away with things ordinary Americans can't, and that they need to be held accountable, even if not criminally, at least morally, at least politically, and that we need to restore a sense of standing up for survivors, protecting America's kids, and having a politics where billionaires can't just buy off politicians and avoid the rules.
Quickly, even though if it would pass the Senate, the president would need to sign it into law, which is unlikely, then what's the point of holding this vote at all? Just a few seconds, Congressman.
First of all, we may get a veto-proof vote in the House. You could get that in the Senate, and it will put such incredible pressure for the MAGA base to be voting against the president. That has never happened in his first term or second term.
That's Democratic Representative Ro Khanna of California. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, we've also invited Republican lawmakers to speak with us on this and other news. Those invitations remain open.
Okay, the bill that President Trump signed to end the shutdown also changes the rules for Americans who grow and sell hemp. A lot of hemp comes from Kentucky, where one of the U.S. senators celebrated this change while the other says it will destroy the industry. Joe Sonka with Kentucky Public Radio has the facts.
The 2018 Farm Bill allowed hemp to be grown to make CBD products that include the non-psychoactive component of cannabis, often used to help with pain, anxiety, and sleep. Some in the industry use that hemp to also create a synthetic product like Delta 8 with a higher concentration of THC, mimicking marijuana. That's a loophole, says Senator Mitch McConnell. He used the new spending bill to fix it.
It will keep these dangerous products out of the hands of children while preserving the hemp industry for farmers.
But his fellow Kentucky Senator Rand Paul blasted the provision, saying McConnell's loophole fix went too far and would actually eradicate the booming market of hemp products. Think gummies, candies, oils, and drinks.
This is the most thoughtless, ignorant proposal to an industry that I've seen in a long, long time.
In the end, McConnell won out, and the bill now bans the sale of hemp-derived products with more than 0.4 milligrams of THC per container. That's way too low, says Jim Higdon. He owns Cornbread Hemp, a growing Kentucky company with 100 employees.
That will make illegal all hemp products in America, including non-intoxicating CBD products, will become illegal, will become Schedule I controlled narcotics.
That's because, he says, even non-intoxicating CBD products contain a small amount of THC. The U.S. Hemp Roundtable advocacy group says the new law will wipe out 95% of America's $28 billion hemp industry, costing more than 300,000 jobs. Hemp is different from marijuana, and the ban does not affect that industry. Some conservatives have praised the loophole fix, including Texas Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick. He posted on social media, quote, "I believe this ban will save a generation from getting hooked on dangerous drugs." For his part, Higdon says the ban is an existential threat to his business, but it also won't go into effect until a year from now.
We can pass legislation in this year to get the guardrails that we need to keep hemp products legal in America with an appropriate THC cap per serving.
He remains hopeful that Congress will help him stay in business beyond next year. For NPR News, I'm Joe Salka in Louisville, Kentucky.
This is NPR News.
It's 6:19. Thanks for tuning in. This is People Powered KAXE. Jeff Sundin is away this week, but you can check out our webpage, hear last week's conversation with Jeff, reflecting on 40 years of being a fishing guide in northern Minnesota. Also thinking about things, those bigger topics of things like technology in the boat and some of his favorite things to do, fish for panfish. We receive support from Minnesota Power. They're an elite company powering the region's homes, businesses, and industries since 1923. Learn more about its vision of a carbon-free future at mnpower.com/energyforward. Things going on in our region. It is a free movie tonight with the classic movie series continuing at the Edge Center for the Arts. Each month, the retired professor of film and pop culture, Jack Nackbar, curates a film. This month, it's Rio Bravo. It's with John Wayne, Dean Martin, and Ricky Nelson. It starts at 6:30 tonight, free and open to the public. In the Cass County chapter of Isaac Walton League is hosting a spaghetti dinner fundraiser at Union Church in Hackensack. That is tonight at 5. Presentation on nitrates follows the dinner. The Rife Dance is presenting a special Nutcracker story time at the Grand Rapids Area Library. That is tomorrow at 10:30. A craft time that follows the story, and there'll be photo opportunities with the Rat Queen and Nutcracker.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Odoo, maker of business management software, with the goal of promoting growth and scaling businesses with efficiency. Learn more about Odoo at odoo.com. From Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. Information about ways to prevent and solve homelessness is at melvilletrust.org. From Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool. Customers can see options and rates side by side. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. An employee of a Republican fundraising firm says he quit. Miles Bruner says he wants to make amends for his politics.
For so long, I was working on a project that I feel severely damaged our democracy.
Bruner first wrote his story on the website The Bulwark. He was not a household name, but a guy in the trenches who said he worked for years sending out fundraising appeals he considers deceptive. We invited Bruner to talk about it, and 3 weeks later, he came by. There is a story behind that delay. I saw your article. We reached out. Initially, we heard he's not doing interviews.
Yeah, that's correct.
And then we heard, well, that's because it was kind of overwhelming.
Yes, it was.
Criticizing your political tribe in such a divisive time stirs a lot of reactions.
Expletive rants, and then people like, targeting your family and stuff you really just never think you would ever see.
He went dark for a while, but also heard from supporters who persuaded him the criticism was just words. Bruner is a Californian who says he became political in high school arguing against the liberals on the debate team. He went on to work for a Republican state senator and recalls a moment he grew uncomfortable. His boss publicly criticized a white supremacist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia in 2017.
But we got pushback almost immediately because we had said that the girl killed was a hero. And we kind of had to like walk some of it back or, delete the post. It was so defeating because if we weren't able to call out these attacks, what could we call out? I literally went home and I cried.
You hung on, though, in the party for quite some time, moved to Washington, in fact, and
yes.
Worked not for a campaign directly, but for a company. What was that like?
Personally, the work I was doing aside, I tell everyone, I worked for a great company. I made a decent wage. I was able to start a family because of them.
Campaign Solutions is the name of the company, and they would work for...
Yeah, they did digital fundraising for candidates, PACs, committees, that kind of stuff.
So great company, but...
But we were writing pretty inflammatory fundraising emails on a daily basis. And it was stuff that I found personally abhorrent. But again, you kind of compartmentalize and you rationalize away a lot of those internal disagreements.
You write in the article, quote, it was routine to publish content that pushed election fraud conspiracies, stoked anti-immigrant sentiment, and sowed distrust in our institutions.
Yeah.
Do you remember a particular fundraising email or whatever it was that did that?
I had a couple candidates right after the 2020 election we pushed out, and then they had no evidence in their specific elections that there was any fraud or any untoward behavior by election officials or the Democratic Party. But we took the initiative to say, we don't know what Democrats are up to. Like, this election can go either way because of potential fraud. We need your help. Send money. So that was pretty routine, especially right after the 2020 election.
I think now about why you went along with it and did it. Did you just think, I'm basically their representative. It's like I'm their lawyer. This is their point of view. I'm helping them get across their point of view.
Yeah. You kind of do whatever it takes to win at that point. You figure this is the direction the party's already going. And so the copy is, for lack of a better term, it's working. You know what's getting engagement. And you know that talking about fraud, despite you having no specific knowledge or evidence, is going to work. And so you're going to push whatever you can that maximizes the engagement or dollars in the door for your candidate.
True in social media, true in fundraising.
Yes, very true. And they kind of worked hand in glove together. Whatever is working on social media, they inform what will work on email and then vice versa. So you're always in conversation with each other.
You describe a personal experience that finally pushed you over the edge. In 2023, I think, what happened?
What happened in 2023 had to do with the Supreme Court and the Dobbs decision. I had been pro-life as a kid, younger, and then as I got older, I became more pro-choice, but it still wasn't something I voted on. It was just kind of something in the background.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, then the Dobbs decision happened. I didn't think much of it, but then my wife and I, we were expecting our first child, and then unfortunately, we had a miscarriage. The impact of Dobbs all of a sudden became very real to us.
Meaning you were thinking about what if we had needed?
Yeah, what if we had needed it? What if something had been slightly different? What if we had been in a different part of the country? Then it just became unfathomable to me because this was already a tragedy we were dealing with. Like, we struggled with it for several months. And then to have that other layer of not having the support of the medical community or your own government to help, I just couldn't fathom that. And that's one of the things that really began pushing me over the edge.
You say pushing you over the edge. I'm now picturing you clinging to the edge because you stayed on a couple more years.
Yeah, I stayed on a couple more years. And the reason that is because, again, you find excuses. If something's comfortable, you cling on as much as you can because it's something you know.
Do you remember the day that you decided, I'm really, really doing this. I'm really quitting. I'm writing about it.
For me, it was seeing the masked federal agents in our streets. That's what kind of pushed me over the edge because all up until that point, I was kind of able to rationalize, compartmentalize, and just say, like, I'm just a cog in the machine. I don't matter. And I woke up and I realized, like, there's no way I would be able to justify this to my daughter, like, when she's an adult. I couldn't explain this away.
I could envision someone listening to this interview who's more conservative saying, sure, you were inside the machine, you didn't like the sausage being made, you didn't like how it was being made, but if you were a Democrat, you'd see something just as bad. Do you believe that's true?
All I can say is that I saw what I saw on the Republican side, and I never really heard anything similar that reached the level of what we were putting out. So that's really all I can speak
to. In terms of election denialism or whatever.
Election denialism, anti-immigrant tirades, anti-democratic policies, like those were something that Democrats just weren't putting out.
Miles Bruner, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
We reached out to Campaign Solutions, Bruner's former employer, and have yet to hear back. This is NPR News.
Clothing prices are ticking up thanks to inflation and tariffs, and more people are saying they don't have to buy new stuff, they'll rent it instead.
I don't really want to hang on to pieces forever. The trends will have changed, my taste might have changed.
I'm Elsa Chang, the rising popularity of clothing rentals on All Things Considered from NPR News.
You can hear All Things Considered coming up this afternoon at 4 o'clock. It's here on People Powered KAXC. It's 6:29. I'm Heidi Holton. I don't think there are any clothing rental places in northern Minnesota, but I might be wrong. Have you ever rented clothing? That's one of the stories they'll address this afternoon. Got lots more news coming up. You can text us this morning, 218-326-1234. How are the northern lights where you were last night? The last couple of nights have been pretty spectacular. We'd love to get photos from you or comments. You can text 218-326-1234. Here's what we're looking at in terms of weather today. Sunny skies, highs in the upper 40s to low 50s, west winds around 5. Mostly clear overnight tonight, lows 29 to 34. And mostly sunny tomorrow, Friday, highs 54 to 60, south winds 10 to 20. Evening lows in the mid-30s to low 40s, and by Saturday, mostly sunny, highs 40 to 46 degrees. Coming up from National Native News, current rules defining how the Colorado River is to be shared by 40 million residents in the West will soon expire. The seven basin states had until Tuesday to negotiate those new guidelines. No deal has been struck. We'll learn more about it coming up next. You can learn about the Civil Pledge for a Better Minnesota with Majority in the Middle. That is today from 10:30 to 11:30 at Rapids Brewing Company in Grand Rapids. The pledge affirms a commitment to reject political violence and foster civic trust. You will also learn how small actions can lead to meaningful change. In the Cass County chapter, the Isaac Walton League will host a spaghetti dinner fundraiser at Union Church in Hackensack. That is tonight at 5 p.m.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Current rules defining how the Colorado River is to be shared by 40 million residents in the West will soon expire. The seven basin states had until Tuesday to negotiate those new guidelines. As KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports, no deal was struck.
States still cannot come to terms, leaving tribes lost in the shuffle. Daniel Cordalis is Navajo and runs the Native American Rights Fund's Tribal Water Institute. He believes the Bureau of Reclamation's deadline is arbitrary.
If it means anything, maybe the federal government's going to step in and start throwing some weight around.
When no reclamation nominee has been tapped to replace Trump's old pick, Ted Cook. Beyond the bickering upper and lower basin states, there's 30 federally recognized tribes stuck in the middle of a decades-old debate on how best to divvy the water while keeping the ever-dwindling river flowing.
They have to try to come up with ideas that are doable and that will benefit the entire system, not just tribes. And I hope that none of that is compromised by this deadline coming and going.
For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
Alaska Federation of Natives President Ben Mallah and about 100 other tribal leaders were in Washington, D.C. last week and had a brief visit with Vice President J.D. Vance on Friday. Mallah said it was a good step forward to be invited and is looking forward to more engagement next year. Vance gave a brief presentation on the potential for economic development in Indian country, including manufacturing. Principal Chief of the Cherokee Nation, Chuck Hoskin Jr., said it was good to hear the vice president focus on things that could be done in Indian country. Months before a storm devastated parts of western Alaska, a federal agency canceled a grant that would have helped protect one of the communities from flooding. Ayolna Niden with the Alaska Desk has more on what that money could have done for the village of Kipnuk and what lies ahead for the community.
Raina Paul is the environmental director for the village of Kipnuk. Her house was one of many that was swept upriver during the historic storm last month.
We were so not ready. We were so not prepared.
Paul says the community now needs time to heal and rebuild. The remnants of Typhoon Halon devastated about a dozen villages. Months before the storm, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency canceled a $20 million grant that would have helped Kipnuk protect infrastructure from flooding. Paul says Kipnuk has been losing more than 10 feet of riverbank each year.
We're facing erosion. The sea level is rising. The permafrost is melting.
Paul spent months applying for funding through the EPA's Community Change Grants Program. But the Trump administration terminated the program in May in a broader effort to roll back environmental justice funding. The decision is at the heart of the lawsuit that Kipnuk signed on to in August. The court denied a motion to block the program's termination. The plaintiffs appealed that decision, Cheryl Musgrove is with the Alaska Institute for Justice.
This was a chance for the federal government to finally show that they cared and that they were willing to invest in this small community in remote Alaska.
EPA Press Secretary Bridget Hirsch said that the funding would not have prevented destruction in the community. Hirsch said that, quote, while partisans on the left would apparently prefer to have seen those precious tax dollars washed away, EPA now has the resources available to ensure the money is spent appropriately and wisely, end quote. Musgrove says the first year of the grant was meant for planning, and the construction would have not begun by the time of the storm. She says that the first phase would have also included hazardous waste removal.
Now that's in the river in the Bering Sea.
Musgrove says she hopes that the devastation of the storm highlights the needs of the villages like Kipnuk and helps them mobilize resources for finding long-term solutions. In Anchorage, I am Alona Naiden.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding in part from the Annenberg Foundation, the Ford Foundation, but no longer the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. It is 6:35. I'm Heidi Holton. Coming up, we've got our album of the week. It is by Mavis Staples. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Thanks for staying in touch with us through our text line, 218-326-1234. Our question of the week is about home ec and shop classes. We want to know what you remember. Did you learn something? Were you not good at something? Tell us your stories. You can text 218-326-1234. Support this morning comes from North Homes Children and Family Services, providing mental health care in Minnesota. November is National Adoption Awareness Month, highlighting the need for adoptive and foster care families. North Homes provides licensing and case management for those opening their heart and home. More information is available at northhomes.org. Mavis Staples has a brand new release out. It was released while she is currently 86 years young, and she is as defiant in the face of evil and as hopeful for a brighter future as she has ever been. It's called Sad and Beautiful World, and it was produced by Brad Cook and features guests like Buddy Guy, Waxahachie, Bon Iver, Derek Trucks, MJ Lenderman, and more.
Sometimes I get so sad. Sometimes you just make me mad. It's a just won't go. Sometimes I just won't say no.
Brand new and heartbreaking from Mavis Staples. We all need a little heartbreaking song once in a while. Sad and beautiful.
We all need a little Mavis Staples, let's be real.
I know. What an album coming from her. It is got so many voices and folks involved. She always kind of spreads the love, too, on her albums. You know,
she does. I appreciate that.
Interesting people, and it's never the same.
That's true. And, she's got people like... And I love how she mixes the new with the legacy artists as well.
Mm-hmm.
Like she's got the, you know, Waxahachie's real buzzy artist who has had an incredible year. And then she also, Buddy Guy, mm-hmm. you know, those kinds of, she goes all over the map with who she lifts up. And I really love that about Mavis.
Yeah, you can read more and... more about other great music into the station, check out KAXE.org. New features coming from our music department. You want to talk about that?
Yeah. So we started this. We've always done the real big write-up about the album of the week. And, we thought just kind of in looking at what people might be interested in, we decided to switch it up a little bit. And we're doing this thing called Fresh Picks each week, where we're talking about albums that have been recently released or just released and or singles that have been new out into the world that we think you might enjoy. And we're trying to tailor it to match what we play here on KAXE. And it's just a fun, there's little, you know, you can preview the songs within the write-up. We just had a volunteer class last night and mm-hmm. one of the new volunteers who's going to be doing After Dark on Saturday nights. He said that has been the last 2 weeks he's been checking our list and he's been digging into the music there. So that was fun to hear.
Yeah. Yeah. I think everyone's a little sick of the algorithms and mm-hmm. you might like this if you're listening to, you know, any subscription.
Which gives you basically another artist that's very similar.
Yeah, and you feel a little bit, I don't know. I don't know how to explain it, but...
Cold.
Yeah, there's just something about it. You're looking for like an actual recommendation. I mean, it's the reason you're tuning into KEXE right now, let's be honest, is because real people are putting together ideas and news and music and, you know, telling you about where you live. And, you know, so you've got more opportunity. I think of it as, you know, if you don't have time to kind of dig into music yourself at this moment in life, this is going to make you pretty cool.
It's going to help you out for sure. And mm-hmm. we've talked over the years about it's overwhelming, you know, the amount mm-hmm. of music that's out there. It's can be overwhelming. And that's my job for me.
Yeah.
Much less someone trying to navigate that.
Yeah. It's helpful for me as I've changed positions over the these 25 years or so at KEXC. was able to, you know, I came to the station as a music volunteer yep. and hosting music programs, but you know, there's only so much time in a day that I don't get to dig into music like I used to. So I have long relied on what the music team puts on our website and puts together. I know we've got feedback that folks dig into past albums of the week as well.
Mm-hmm.
So great stuff available at our website, including stories from our news department, stories from the morning show team. You'll want to check it out at KAXE.org. You know, if you're wondering, you hear about maybe the news team doing all this stuff, most of what they're doing, you're going to read on our website, and it's ever-changing all day long. New stories, new things happening. You check it out at KAXE.org. In fact, an hour from now, we've got Chelsea Perkins joining us. She was in a community meeting last night in Emily about a proposed manganese mine mm-hmm. there. So she'll tell us a little more about that before she writes up that story for our website. But there's a lot available at KAXE.org, including a sign up for that Season Watch podcast that's coming out today. We heard from some folks who were deer hunting last weekend. They assigned that to their hunting mates to listen to early morning on the deer stand, and then so they could text each other about what they heard.
No way.
Mm-hmm.
Aww.
Yeah. It's a great way to get more connected to what's going on. So check it out. KEXE.org. And again, Jeff Sundin was away today, but we've got a story from last week where he marked 40 years as a fishing guide available right now as well.
Fall training does continue tonight. I would just mention that we had our class in Grand Rapids last night, and this is if you want to be a DJ at KAXE. These are volunteers, community members who love music, love sharing music, just how Heidi started here and myself. A lot of us on staff started as volunteers because we loved sharing music. And if you do come join us at KBXE in Bemidji, we've got a class from 5:30 to 7 tonight. You can still sign up by emailing volunteer@kaxe.org.
Coming up next, more from Morning Edition. The government shutdown has ended, but extending Affordable Care Act subsidies remains unaddressed, leaving health insurance shoppers in limbo and facing a significant increase in cost. Stay tuned for that story.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C.
Anna Mae Martinez in Los Angeles, California. The government shutdown has ended without resolving a fight over health insurance. Democrats wanted to extend tax credits that have helped many Americans pay their costs since 2021. Many Republicans, though, oppose that, but say they'll consider it now that the shutdown is over. So what happens now?
NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin reports on health policy and joins us now. Hey there, Selena.
Hi, morning, Steve.
How do these tax credits work?
Well, essentially, it's extra financial help from the federal government that brings down the cost of health insurance premiums in the Affordable Care Act marketplaces. So Democrats want to maintain pretty generous subsidies that have, for the last few years, kept premium costs down for about 22 million people. Many Republicans say the subsidies don't address the problem of rising health care costs and that they were supposed to be a temporary pandemic policy whose time has come. Some say they're open to extending them for a year. Democratic senators secured a promise for a vote on this issue, at least in the Senate, before the end of the year. But open enrollment is happening now, which leaves enrollees in a really tricky situation.
Now, you've done something really, really helpful here, because people argue about these issues in the abstract or talk in general terms about who they imagine is receiving the subsidies. But you've been talking to some of the actual people. What are you hearing?
Oh, it is rough. I mean, yesterday I spoke with Amy Jackson. She lives in Butler, Missouri. She's 56. She responded to NPR's call asking to hear from people navigating this right now. She buys coverage on healthcare.gov because her employer is too small to have health benefits. She actually works in medical billing at an independent urgent care center.
Wow.
She told me her insurance premiums are affordable for her at the moment.
Right now it's closer to $300. However, if you don't count the tax credit, it goes to $1,250.
And do you have an extra $1,000 a month?
No, I really don't. No.
Going without insurance is really not an option for her. In October, she was diagnosed with breast cancer. She's rushing to get in as much treatment as she can before the year ends, but she'll still need coverage for follow-up appointments next year. She says she works in the medical field. She knows the insurance industry is part of the problem here. But she says people like her need help now, and congressional lawmakers need to understand that.
You know, for them, $1,000 is probably nothing. It's probably what they blow on dinner. But for me, that's half of my wage. You know, I just can't swing that.
She's been reaching out to her representatives. She says lawmakers could just flip a switch and fix this.
Is that right? Is it that simple?
I mean, if there were political will and bipartisan agreement, yes, Congress could extend the subsidies pretty easily. It's not cheap. The Congressional Budget Office estimates it would cost about $350 billion over 10 years to keep subsidizing people's premiums so much. Republicans control both houses of Congress and the White House, so even if senators come up with a bipartisan bill, it would need to get through the House, and President Trump would need to sign it. So what really happens here depends on Republican leadership, and right now there's only been some signals that an extension might be possible, but no concrete deal has come through yet.
What should people do who are supposed to sign up now?
Well, they can definitely go in and shop and get an idea, but they should probably keep one eye on the news. That's what Amy Jackson told me she's doing. And there's about a month to go before people have to pick a plan that begins January 1st.
NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
President Trump has talked about St. Louis, among other cities, as a potential next target for sending federal agents. Missouri's governor recently authorized a National Guard deployment to St. Louis after the Department of Homeland Security and the Pentagon asked for help. St. Louis Public Radio's Andrea Henderson reports that black police officers there worry it'll erode the trust they've built with communities of color and could be difficult to reverse.
There's about 200 people packed in a gym in St. Louis. A few local immigrant advocacy and civil rights groups are hosting a town hall to teach residents how to protect themselves against a potential influx of federal agents in the city. St. Louisan Jaden Booth works and lives in spaces where Hispanic and African Americans are the majority. He came to the event to learn how to be a better resource for vulnerable people.
It matters a lot to me that I'm prepared for whenever they try to come out here to be able to resist in the right way.
Booth, who is Black, isn't a fan of immigration agents or National Guard members coming into communities of color as a form of policing.
The over-policing of our communities causes more poverty, more crime, and more broken families.
Like in most American cities, crime is down in St. Louis. Over the past year, violent and property crimes decreased, and its homicide rate is lower than it was before the pandemic. Yet, President Trump recently said he had to, quote, save St. Louis by sending in the National Guard. In October, Missouri's Republican governor activated the state's National Guard to help ICE agents with clerical duties. The governor's office didn't respond to a request for an interview. Some fear sending in troops drives a wedge between police and the community. Like Donnie Walters, president of St. Louis's Black Police Officers Union.
We've made progress in our minority communities and police relations by engaging the community events. And this type of heavy-handed tactic is pushing us backwards.
Walters is concerned for what happens after federal agents leave.
Let's say they come in for 6 weeks. Whatever they're doing, however they're doing it, when they leave, we now are left with the fallout.
Walter says this should also worry Black police officers across the country. Renee Hall, president of the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Executives, says targeting people of color stokes fear.
I've been in law enforcement 26 years. And if my officers went into communities and made arrests and masks, there would be a level of outrage, as there should be.
Hall says collaborations with federal agencies are common in cities, but they work in tandem with officers who know the community. She says the recent aggressive tactics by federal agents in cities like Chicago and Los Angeles resemble policing during Jim Crow.
It takes us back hundreds of years as it relates to policing and communities. And it's just performative and it doesn't get us the results of reducing crime.
Jason Watson leads Show Me Peace, a city-funded gun violence prevention group in St. Louis. He says he isn't focused on if or when federal agents come to St. Louis because he's already doing the work.
Regardless if agents are here or not, I don't get a choice to pull in or pull out. We live here. We from here. At the end of the day, the people that I know are still going to be looking for us to show up.
Watson and Walter say that's exactly what activists and Black police officers plan to do, no matter what. For NPR News, I'm Andrea Henderson in St. Louis.
This is NPR News.
This is The Set List on KAXE, where we highlight live music around the area for the upcoming week. I'm Malachi Coons. We are taking a look at four shows this week, Friday and Saturday, November 14th and 15th, in Aiken, Baxter, Gilbert, and Grand Rapids. Starting things off, acclaimed folk musician, theater composer, and disability rights activist Galen Lee is playing at the Underground in Aiken this Friday, a new venue in the basement of the Ripple Center. The singer and violinist has collaborated with artists like Michael Stipe and Alan Sparhawk, won the 2016 NPR Tiny Desk competition, and recently scored the latest run of Macbeth on Broadway. Galen Lee at the Underground this Friday at 6 p.m. in Aiken. In Baxter, Americana and roots rocker Christopher David Hansen is playing Jack Pine Brewery Friday at 6 p.m. A prolific musician, Hansen plays in multiple northern Minnesota bands and mixes blues, rock, and singer-songwriter folk in his solo music. The third Friday show is Jay Streitz at the Ore House in Gilbert, 7 p.m. Strites is an alt-country songwriter who spent years as a bass player in Twin Cities country bands. He now lives in the Northwoods and leads the group Jay Strites and the Long Odds. It's this Friday, 7 p.m. at the Ore House in Gilbert. And finally, one Saturday show for you is the duo Between Howls at Rapids Brewing at 6 p.m. Ren and Nick Howell are both top-notch musicians whose live show ranges from breakneck shredding to soulful ballads and everything in between. They released their debut album Cabin Fever earlier this year. Between Howls this Saturday at Rapids Brewing, 6 p.m. The set list is made possible by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
Coming up, we've got the Up North Report, local news from our region. That's also available as a podcast. Check it out at KEXE.org or any of those podcast platforms that you use already. That's right. We receive support here on KAXE from Rapids Brewing Company, a place for gathering and community featuring live music multiple times a week, farm fresh food, and rotating beers from their own brew house. More information about their events, music, and menu available at rapidsbrewingco.com. Coming up today, 9 o'clock, DJ Dang is our host for Headwaters. Judy Gruey's in, the woman with one name.
Yeah, it's not
one
Judy.
One word name.
It's Judy Gruey.
Judy Gruey.
Yep.
And tonight at 7 o'clock, it is The Dead Set with Papa Steve Ross. Hey, that's cool. The new volunteer class will get to see
in action
Steve Ross.
Yeah, which was fun because last night at KAXE, they were able to see Dave Murphy in action. And, you know, our volunteers sometimes sell us better than we do.
Yeah.
So that was nice to have Dave here and be able to, and just to be able to speak to the volunteers about how fun it is,
right.
How fun it is to DJ a show. So we do have room. There's no cap, actually, on how many come to this class tonight. But we do have a class that you can still sign up for from 5:30 to 7 at KBXE in Bemidji. You can sign up for that by emailing volunteer@kaxe.org. Also tonight, there is the Cass County chapter of the Isaac Walton League hosting a spaghetti dinner fundraiser at Union Church in Hackensack at 5 o'clock, and then a presentation on nitrates follows the dinner.
Bemidji Community Theater has Anne of Green Gables, the musical, beginning this week. It starts tomorrow night and goes through next weekend as well. You can listen to and read the story at KEXD. Andrew Dezingle digging down into Anne of Green Gables. And I hear, I don't know if you've seen the photo of the girl that's playing Anne.
No.
She looks like Anne Shirley.
Is it on our website?
Yes.
Okay, I need to find
I'm
this.
Like, whoa, that is Anne Shirley.
Oh, she does.
I mean, I don't think Gilbert Blythe is in that photo, but.
No, I don't think.
I'm so surprised that we all just can't get over that our very own Jen Kellen
has never. I just, okay.
So how is she even our friend?
Well, and okay, I say this myself just reading Anne of Green Gables
right.
for the first time.
That's right.
But I grew up with an older sister who is around Jen's age, and I just assumed that that I was like the only one that didn't read it, I guess. So I was even really shocked.
I shouldn't even be that way because there's lots of books where people assume I have read them and all of that, and I just haven't. But it is, I don't know.
But it just felt like a very Jen book in the youth of
Jen
Kellen.
Yeah, I mean, I remember we were...